Thanks for the introduction. So what we thought about is that computer industry or computers do a lot for biology. Then we try to revert that. What can biology do for computers? And what came about is that the circulation system, the blood circulation system that we have, is a very efficient means of transporting material and heat. So we try to combine different fields, biology, physics, and chemistry, in order to have a more efficient computer. So let me start with an overview of what I plan to explain you. So what we see is that data centers consume more and more energy. And in fact, all the energy, the electrical energy, ends up as hot air, and that is a waste. So we are wasting millions and even billions of dollars yearly in data centers, and that trend is increasing. So we had a doubling of energy consumption in data centers in the last 4 years. And now, since about 2 or 3 years, there is also we have learned that the energy consumption can affect the climate, and there is quite some interest from the politicians to try to reduce the overall carbon emission by industry and also by data centers, and to that also the data centers contribute to that effect. And of course, it's not only political interest, it's also an economic interest that the amount of energy consumed by data centers is reduced. So then I will introduce you to the technologies, the underlying technologies that can help to improve the efficiency of chips. And that starts with thermal interfaces. So thermal conductivity between the chip and the heatsink is important, and also how the heat is then transferred from the heatsink to the medium, which is air currently and will be liquid in the future. How we can focus the cooling onto the locations where most heat is dissipated. You probably have learned that in the recent past. So data centers are less efficient when there are hotspots, which require a different set point of the AC system. And if the heat dissipation is distributed, then the efficiency of a data center can be higher. The same applies also to a cooling by liquid on the chip level. So we have to focus the cooling on where most heat is being dissipated. Then I explain you the history of liquid cooling. What were the first steps? There was a cycle about 15 to 20 years ago where already liquid cooling was used. And then I'm showing you the trend that cold liquid cooling is an efficient method. Warm liquid cooling is even better, and hot liquid cooling is the best in terms of an overall system efficiency. Then I combine the liquid cooling with the trend, the current trend, to increase efficiency of chips by stacking several chips on top of each other. And here in this part, I'll show you that energy can be reused, the energy dissipated by the processors, and that can be reused in community or district heating systems. And there is a lot of activity, in particular in Europe, in that area. And we are demonstrating a system together with the Technical University in Zurich, which is called ETH. And we have recently announced that we are building a hot liquid-cooled system for ETH. And the system is called Aquasar. Then finally, what are the main messages when we have a hot liquid-cooled system? How can we operate it? And what does it have for an impact on the IT industry? So we think by building such systems in large volume within 5 years, we can have a beneficial effect on the overall climate. and that the role of IT industry is then to provide a solution to this and not to be a problem in this context. And finally, to kind of expand the topic, the capability of removing heat from chips can also be applied in concentrated photovoltaic systems and also allows to make these systems much more efficient than they are currently being built. Now, the trend in data centers, I already mentioned, the energy consumption of data centers went up in the last 4 years. It doubled in the last 4 years. And if you look at the balance between hardware investment cost and energy cost in the last decade, you see that about 10 years ago, energy cost was always almost negligible. As we are now, 2008 to 2009, the energy cost is roughly the same size as the hardware investment cost. And if you look at this trend, it's continuing. We may face a situation where energy cost is dominating the overall total cost of ownership of a data center. In the last 4 years, the energy has doubled, and now the overall energy consumption of the information and telecommunication industry is already of the order of 2% of the overall energy consumption, which is as much as global aviation consumes. And of course, there is the associated carbon footprint with that because electrical energy is mostly produced from coal firing. If we look at this energy consumption, the fraction in data centers is slightly lower, so there is about 1.2% of US energy in servers being consumed. And now we look at the servers. Actually, in a data center, we have a certain electrical input, but only about 30% of the overall electrical input, in fact, goes into the boxes. And roughly the same amount of energy that goes into the IT equipment is being needed to drive the heat pump or chiller. And all the energy that went into the data center then ends as waste. And we want to change this situation because that's a very large fraction of the energy that is being wasted overall then. So what is the culprit actually? So the main consumer here is the heat pump. And the reason why we need this heat pump at all is that there is a very large temperature gradient that is needed to move the heat from the transistors, which are up here, this is a temperature scale, to the environment eventually. So we need to drive the flow of the heat by applying a very low temperature, which has to be produced by an air conditioning equipment or heat pump, and that costs a lot of energy. And finally, we need a cooler, an evaporative cooling tower on the roof to get rid of the energy that we needed to run the hardware and the chiller. Now, I said the trend is that we are consuming more and more energy in data centers. And as you all know, there is a lot of applications that are driving demand in data centers. It's all about telecommunication, mobility, digital media, e-commerce, high-performance computing is also adding to that trend, and some other applications. So what we notice is that the number of transistor switching cycles is increasing about 30% per year in data centers, and traditionally the information industry has been able to increase the efficiency of their systems by about 15% per year. So 15% per year efficiency increase with a 30% demand increase still means there is a large increase in energy consumption. And that causes a problem. It causes a problem on all levels. It causes a problem on the the transistor level. It causes a problem on the module and on the package. And since a few years, we know that it not only causes problems up to the data center level, but even beyond. So we need to rethink the way how we are using data centers or how we're driving, running data centers. And in fact, we notice that there are other ways that we can run the data center, which reduces the overall impact on all levels. And if we do that, we can reduce the impact of information technology on the climate, so that the information technology industry is a part of the solution to the climate problem, and not a part of the problem. And myself, I'm personally motivated to work in this area because I'm doing winter mountaineering in Switzerland. And myself, I have seen actually the trend of glaciers that they are shrinking. So what you see is different pictures of the one particular glacier, Matarazzo Glacier, at an earlier date, and more recently you see that all these glaciers are shrinking, and glaciers are accumulating thermometers, so they definitely tell what is the environmental temperature averaged over a decade or so. And I wouldn't have needed actually Al Gore to tell me that. I have seen that personally with my own eyes, and every year that I'm returning to this same location, I see the glacier to have retracted a few more meters. And the bad thing is that the trend even accelerates. So with every year, the distance of retraction is larger. So I think I would like to contribute to solve this problem. And that is possible by reducing the overall emission of data centers. Let's say one additional point, if we are reducing, the best thing would be to reduce the overall energy consumption. The best energy is always the energy not used. And one could think the IT industry should invest more into making the transistors more efficient. And we have actually done that the last 50 years. But we are now facing technical problems, or it's even physical barriers that are preventing us from increasing the efficiency of the transistors. And the other problem we are facing is that not the majority of the energy is actually dissipated in the transistors in a chip, but the majority of energy is being dissipated in the wires. And if we're changing or improving the efficiency of the transistors, if all the energy is dissipated in the wires, we don't profit that much. So we are clearly facing problems in increasing the efficiency of the primary process. And what you see here is a summary of the International Technology Roadmap for Semiconductors on topics that are important for transistor efficiency. What you see is the roadmap usually indicates the trend, the technology trend, and shows where most research has to be done. That's the yellow zone. So that means there is no usable solution. Only with a lot of research we can get to a solution. And the red zones show there is no known solutions. And you see the problems already start now, that there are, in some aspects, relevant for energy consumption and efficiency, there are no known solutions, so that we cannot have any efficiency increase in the near future coming from the chips themselves. And we need to think how we can keep the pace of the industry as it was in the past, or with this outside political pressure, we would want to even increase the pace. And of course, now the raw performance of a computer is not so important anymore, but the efficiency, and there has been quite a considerable increase. In one example, of high performance computing, the Earth simulator, which was the leading system in 2002, had a efficiency of 3.4 megaflops per watt. And now, 6 years later, the leading computer has a efficiency of 445 megaflops per watt. And that's, in fact, a 27 times increase in performance, and still at a fifth of the overall power consumption. So that was quite a progress. But it's not enough. Still, the trend to more power consumption goes up. And we, in fact, should not only count the energy that is going into the boxes, that's this energy, the 2.5 megawatts here, but we should also count the energy that goes into the whole facility. And that would require another metric than we used in the past. So in the past, it was the top 500 list, which was the important metric. That will change in the future to the green 500 list, which shows which is the most efficient system among the top 500. And we even propose another list so that the most efficient facility is leading then this list. Now I'd like to look a little bit into the past. So what are the historical trends in power density and energy consumption in the last few decades? What you see is that there was a trend in module heat flux going strongly upwards with the former technology that was used for building computers. That was the bipolar technology, which was very fast but not efficient. And that caused an increase in power density per module. So at this point, already water cooling was required. Then after this point, there was another technology available, which is the current CMOS technology, that has a much higher efficiency. The performance per transistor was not so high at this time when the switch happened, but the overall efficiency was higher. And for this reason, the heat flux, the module heat flux, really dropped down. Now we are on an upward ramp again, and we are even higher than we were at the peak power densities of the bipolar technology, and trend is going strongly upwards. But the problem we have now is there is no technology ready where we can jump to. So we really have to face the problem and try to solve this. One partial solution can come from the process we're developing now, the stacking of chips. So the stacking of chips reduces the wire length in between the functional units. And as I said before, the energy consumption is already dominated by the wire length. So by reducing the wire length, we can reduce the overall amount of energy consumed. But the problem we have this time, when we stack several chips on top of each other, we even increase the heat flux. So on this map, the jump to the next technology, which is 3D packaging, will not result in a jump downwards, but it will be resulting in a jump upwards. So that's why we need to really invest a lot into developing technologies that can handle the high heat fluxes in the future. And that was the motivation for us in the Zurich Research Laboratory to start the project 6 years ago. Another historic trend, the 8088 could be cooled using natural convection without even a heatsink attached. And as we are looking on the trend, Pentium 3, Pentium 4, and Apple G5 here, you see that the volume of the heatsink from the first needed to the current one is at least a factor in 10. We need much more volume for the heatsink. It's much more expensive and also much more complex. This is a water-cooled version, but also the air-cooled versions are difficult or complex because there is not only copper involved, there is heat pipes involved. Here you see them. So it's really very complex, and the trend is actually opposing the trend we see. Boxes become smaller, heat sinks become larger. So that cannot work. So we need to revert that trend. Another historic part was the water-cooled module that was used in one of the IBM machines, 3090. That was on the peak power density of this bipolar trend. And what you see is that there are individual chips assembled on a multi-chip module, and each chip is thermally contacted by this pedestal, and then the whole thing gets water-cooled. And this is traditional water cooling using large diameter channels. There were two versions available, air-cooled, but you see this huge volume needed for the air cooler. The liquid cooler was already smaller, but the actual power densities removed by this thermal conduction module is not that impressive, because we can handle now this very same power density easily with air cooling. Now, I said this trend in power density is our motivation to start an increased effort in so-called packaging research. And we think with increased packaging research, and in particular 3D packaging, we can compensate this imminent trend that the efficiency increase and performance increase due to chip scaling. So making transistors smaller and smaller every 3 years is called chip scaling as a process. And the chip scaling was the main driver for Moore's law in the past 50 years almost. And we are now risking that slows down. We try to compensate this by an increased effort in packaging. And when we accelerate this effort, as the other process slows down, we think we can maintain the same pace in the next decade to come. So how will the system look like? It's a complex module with passives here in the carrier, and then chips in several layers mounted on top of this interconnection device. Also, the whole industry reports that acceleration in pace acceleration of pace in assembly and packaging is an important trend. So what is thermal packaging? We typically have the chips on a carrier that provides all the power supply and electrical communication, and the chips are mounted with a so-called C4 technology, flip chip technology, on this carrier, and then we have one surface available for transporting away the heat. So we have a first thermal interface, a cap, a second thermal interface, and eventually the air cooler currently. And that will then be replaced by a liquid cooler. And the first problem, the kind of short-term problem we have, is that the thermal resistance of this thermal interface material, TIM1 and TIM2, is quite high. So one could think, let's connect the chip directly with a metallic heatsink. That's unfortunately not possible, because there is thermal gradients in the chip, and the thermal expansion coefficient of the chip is very much different than of the heatsink, and a temperature difference of 20 or 30 degrees will cause the chip to crack. So it's not possible to directly mount those and have a good thermal contact to the cap, but we need a thermal interface material. And in the past, that was causing about 50% of the thermal gradient. So this is the first topic we have to solve, and we have been working on that. It's a thermal interface technology that relies on here small channels by, fabricated by microtechnology in the thermal cap, and that these channels direct the paste during the squeezing process to the right locations, and in particular they direct the particles in this thermal paste so that they assemble nicely on the surface and create an efficient thermal path. Cutting channels into heat sinks is a very simple process and can be introduced in the industry very quickly. So the in order for the system to work, the channels cannot be just one size, but they need to be different. So we need large channels, a few large channels, and more smaller channels. For this reason, it's called a hierarchical process, hierarchical nested channels. With these, we can create thinner bond lines, so the thickness is causing the thermal resistance, and the specific conductivity can be increased, and the assembly can be with lower forces and faster. So that's an important benefit. Here again is shown how the particles, they're conducting the heat, how they're assembled nicely on the surface, and direct the heat towards the heatsink. If you don't do that, what happens is the particles, they all assemble on the main diagonal. That means then we have a good thermal conductivity on the main diagonal. If you're cutting a channel onto this main diagonal, the particle stack is actually chased around and creates a new line. And again, on this new line, you can cut the channel, or you can do the hierarchical approach by subdividing the square from the top. And eventually, we're able to nicely distribute those particles on the entire surface and creating a better thermal contact. So a three times thinner bond line, three times higher specific conductivity makes about a 10 times better overall performance. So that helps a lot. And if you solve that problem, we are, of course, facing the next problem, which is then the heatsink. So the deck will be then in the hot seat. And again, kind of nice comparison. A typical high-performance processor weighs, a chip weighs about 2 grams. The transistors on the chip, so the chip is only a carrier. The transistor is about 10 microns thick with all the wiring. They weigh about 2 milligrams. And the cooler, to cool that thing, weighs 2 kilograms. So we need a million times more mass to do the thermal management than we actually need to build the transistors. So this is a strange ratio. If you're exchanging the heat carrier from air to water, we have a much higher volumetric heat capacity available, 4,000 times better, and we also have a better thermal conductivity available. It's about a factor of 30. And these two differences allow to build a cooler, a liquid cooler, much smaller. So it's almost the factor of the heat capacity that we can build it smaller. So it doesn't weigh then 2 kilograms, but it only weighs as much as the chip weighs, about 2 grams or slightly more. So it's really then the heat sink has the same kind of scale that the chip itself has. So that's an important benefit. And the other benefit is that heat, once it is being absorbed into liquid, can be carried much more easy over longer distances. Air is difficult to transport. For example, a high-performance computer, a BlueJeans in its full size, will require 0.5 cubic kilometer air per hour to cool. How do you get 0.5 cubic kilometer air transported? So with liquid, it will be in a much smaller volume. Now, I mentioned my background is biophysics, and we have been thinking, how can we use biological principles to improve the efficiency of computers? And the first topic was the system of arteries and veins, which we used, we built in silicon technology such a system. So what is the virtue of this, our blood circulation system? We have a hierarchically branched system. We have one input, which is being driven by the heart, and then we have a branched system that eventually drives billions of capillaries. And the heat exchange and the mass transport, which is important for us, happens all in the capillaries. And they typically have a length of 100 micron and a diameter of 10 microns. Now are able to use silicon technology, deep trench etching, to build capillaries of the same dimension. So it's standard microtechnology that can do that. And what you see here is a chip which is being cooled by a lot of these streams, they are fed by two systems. And it's always important that we have two systems. We need a system to provide access of the fluid, and we need to have another system that drains the fluid. And two intermixed hierarchical systems are very complex to build. It's really, we have to see that there is no collisions. But it's possible using here a system that does a threefold branching in one dimension, in X, and a threefold branching in Y. So we have, per layer of silicon, we have a ninefold branching. And what we want to achieve is to drive 50,000 nozzles and capillaries per chip using one input. So we need about four layers of these ninefold branching. And then we can kind of implement the biological system. By the way, the biology prefers bifurcation, so always one channel is split in two. From a technology point, we calculated that trifurcation is the best because we're using right angles. If we really go into theory, then it turns out that about 2.5-fold branching is the most efficient. So biology kind of went to the two-fold branching, bifurcation, while technology will go to the trifurcation. But it's the same basic principle then that allows to improve the heat transfer, and that has been shown in technical papers. So the heat transfer we can reach with that is 350 watts per square centimeter. This is about 10 times more than a hot plate dissipates. Now we're working in this area to even increase heat transfer beyond the normal capability of water. So we are using also nanotechnology, nanofluids to investigate improved heat transfer. That's a longer term research. The other aspect of this research was, how can we build very thin liquid coolers? So that would allow a much denser spacing of future boards. So the current spacing, the most dense spacing of a board, is limited by the vertical dimension of the air heat sink for the processor, which is of the order of 13 millimeters or 1U. While if you're building a high-performance fluid cooler, we can restrict that on a packaging level to 2 millimeters. Here is an example of such a system. We are having small channels. So they are doing the heat transfer. These are the capillaries, same dimensions of about 20 micron. And the length of the biological capillary is about 100 microns. So we're using also about 100 to 200 microns. We have now a more rectangular version of implementing that, has been recently published. So you see here an inlet coming from one side, cold water, and the outlet on the other side, and everything very compact so that the whole cooler doesn't need a vertical access here, it only needs lateral access, and the thickness is less than 2 millimeters. So we can really densify electronics in the future from 30 millimeters minimum to 2 millimeters minimum on a packaging level. So that was the first effort to really have higher, more compact systems. And as I said before, I'm repeating that, more compact systems save energy because the wires are shorter. Another topic that we looked into is, how can we do liquid cooling without requiring an external liquid connection? Because on mobile systems, you probably wouldn't like to connect your laptop to a liquid system. So we need to benefit from the performance advantages of liquid cooling while still rejecting the heat to air. And that was an interesting research topic that we started. So we need liquid pumps. We need a hermetic system. And that is driven using membrane pumps, like voice coils, like a loudspeaker. And this shuttles water back and forth between two compartments. So that's here, left, right. That's interesting, but even more interesting is if we're shuttling another set or using another set of voice coils to transport water up and down here. And if we combine them with all a 90 degree offset in phase, we are getting this rotating flow vector. So the benefit of this is the flow speed on the chip is always the same, only the direction changes. If you're only using a lateral oscillation, no vertical component, then we have a maximum flow, and then there is a short stop, and then the flow comes back. So we have temperature oscillations. With this radially oscillating flow, we can avoid temperature oscillations and create a system that has a performance approximating the performance of a liquid cooler with external connection for fluid, while still rejecting the heat to air and allowing a mobile system, a mobile high-performance system. In order to make that happen, the heat transfer from the solid chip to the fluid, we need a fine mesh of copper here, which is stacked on top of each other. We have these layers about 200 microns thick, then we have 200 micron channels here. So it's not as small as the example I showed last, but still the performance is quite good. And we need the heat exchanger to accept the heat from the chip. And we here have four heat exchangers that then reject the heat to the air. The overall power density that can be cooled with such a system is of the order of 180 watts per square centimeter. I showed before the performance of a liquid cooler is 350 and more watts per square centimeter. And by the way, the performance of this cooler here is I haven't written it 700 watts per square centimeter. Now, in order to improve heat transfer even further, we have to understand the power density, the power map of a chip. So if you look at a typical chip, it has different areas. The majority of the area in a current chip is cache memory. Cache memory has a fairly low power density. And a certain area is high power density. Usually there is the arithmetic logic unit and some other units. But these units only occupy between 5 and 10% of the surface. And classically, if a liquid cooler was built, it was built so that the same flow of water or liquid goes over the entire chip. And that's actually a waste, because we should focus the majority of the flow on the hotspots, while these low power density zones don't need that much of flow. And if you're doing the calculation, if you're focusing the fluid onto the hotspots, we can reduce the amount of fluid flow by a factor of 8. That's one thing. We can reduce the pumping power of the liquid pump by a factor of 8. And at the same time, we can increase the thermal gradient of the fluid that comes out by a factor of 8. That means the heat becomes more valuable if you want to reuse the heat. That's the important message. So we save a lot of energy on pumping. We have much better cooling of the hotspots, and our heat becomes more valuable. So focusing cooling onto hotspots is an important point to develop these heat reuse systems. You probably have seen now similar effects happening on air-cooled data centers. They also have hotspots. And these hotspots cause a waste of energy, because the set point of the air conditioning is always has to be like this, that the hottest place in the data center doesn't get overheated. And if we're distributing the heat load over the entire data center regularly, then we can turn down the set point, and the lower set point or a higher temperature set point on an air conditioner will save a lot of energy. Now, some more longer term work we're doing in order to improve heat transfer is by modeling heat transfer from a solid into a fluid. So this is a real long-term research, time horizon 10 to 15 years. But still the benefit we can get is quite considerable. So what we did, we started with this type of research and looked at heat transfer from a silicon surface into water by molecular dynamics modeling. And we compared two different surfaces, either a surface that is silicon with hydrogen, a hydrophobic surface, and a silicon surface which has OH groups on the surface, and this is a hydrophilic surface. And we found out that heat transfer here in a hydrophilic surface is much better. So how can we explain that in simple terms? Heat transfer is very similar to optics. And all of you that use glasses like to have anti-reflective coatings because they improve the performance of the glasses a lot, especially in sunlight. So we can do the same thing on a heat transfer device. So we can introduce anti-reflective coatings for the heat waves, and of course the heat waves are called phonons. But it's the same physics. And we can use the experiences we have from optics also in such surfaces and also in stacks of, for example, silicon and silica. Why are we interested in that? Is because there is a trend that transistors are built in silicon on insulator technology. Silicon on insulator technology improves the electrical performance a lot, but decreases the thermal performance because we are having a reflective layer between a silicon oxide and silica, between silicon and silicon oxide, sorry. And if we're building stack chips, we'll have several layers then of these silicon and silicon oxide, and that causes a thermal problem. So we need to understand early enough that we can improve heat transfer, and especially that we can pre-screen novel devices, novel ways of building electronics with the viewpoint that not better electronical circuits are created at the expense of a lot worse thermal performance. So in the future, we will have to do a electrical thermal co-design. That means we have to optimize both the electrical and thermal performance. And for that reason, research into phonon transport engineering is very important. That's also a longer-term effort. The final topic, how can we reduce pumping power in a microchannel system? One approach uses the Lotus effect. Lotus effect means that the liquid doesn't entirely wet the surface. And you probably have seen that on a lotus leaf, the drops really roll away very easily. We can make use of that in a cooling system so that the liquid can flow much more efficient through a channel. And the important number characterizing a efficiency of a heat transfer system will be the coefficient of performance, which means the additional energy needed to transport the heat away. And in a current data center, the additional energy needed to transport the heat is 100%. We want to have only less than 5% energy needed to transport the heat from the data center to a second user. Now, what I told before was about water cooling. Now, we can also use different fluids to do cooling. These fluids have always kind of strange names, R236FA and so on. These are so-called refrigerants, and they do not electrically conduct, so they're so-called dielectric fluids. They have the benefit that they reduce the risk for electronics, so in case there is a leak, there is no electrical hazard. But that goes at the expense of a much lower thermal performance. So the thermal performance of these refrigerants is about 5 times worse than water, 5 times lower thermal capacity, and also about 5 times lower thermal conductivity than water. And that requires that we use the latent heat of phase change. So what we need to boil the fluid. And if we boil the fluid, we can get roughly the same heat out of a chip. But the system to run and control that process, it's so-called flow boiling in a microcapillary, so there is a microchannel, and we do flow boiling. That is much more difficult to control and requires much more instrumentation. So for those who are really worried to have water in a future package, they can take this system, but it will be more expensive. Now, next. When not more efficiency is possible from scaling chips, we can try other approaches. One approach that everybody sees now is as we distribute the compute load between different cores, we are increasing the performance. Everybody knows that a 2-core chip is much more powerful than a 1-core chip. Now, 4-core chips are coming onto the market. And the question is, great, let's go for 1,000-core chips. They are 1,000 times as efficient. Unfortunately not. The reason for this is that the number of communication lines per chip is limited by the C4 technology. So we're having always the same number of lines between the processor and the off-chip memory. That requires a scaling of the cache memory in order to get the same performance with the third power. So for 2 cores, you need 8 times as much cache. For 4, you need 64. And you can understand that you quickly run out of space on a chip. So the trend to multi-core is a great trend, but it will stop after 8 or 16 cores because there is not enough space. So what can we do? We can stack the chips. So there is a industry now really trying and investing a lot into stacking chips, and the final device will look like this. It has one logic layer and a few memory layers, so you have much more space available. And importantly, you can have much more communication lines between the processor logic layer and the memory. And the key technology that is currently being developed is the through-silicon via technology, this TSV technology. So this is a layer which is of the order of 100 microns thick. So that's the silicon is being thin. The chip is not 700 microns thick anymore, but very thin. And we have high aspect ratio metallic wires through that. That connects one layer here of memory with a layer of logic. And the density of these wires can be much higher than the external connection of the chip to the board. And for this reason, this technology has the capability of increasing efficiency of processing by at least an order of magnitude. The problem we are having, though, is that we have to cool this system from the backside. And so what happens if we're stacking 10 layers, we have 10 times the heat flux, and we have 10 times the thermal resistance. So it's a quadratic problem. So that will run quickly out of steam. And here are the comparisons. So what can we do with so-called backside cooling? We have a high-performance cold plate here. And then we have several layers. We could cool a logic layer with quite a thick stack of memory below it, 10 layers, but only 3 layers on top. As soon as we are trying to integrate 2 logic layers, we are already in trouble. It works when we make sure that the hotspots don't overlap, because the hotspots usually are 10 times denser in energy density than the rest. But it definitely will not work when we have overlaying hotspots or more than 2 layers. So we need to think, how can we cope with this situation? So this cooling is the highest performance possible cold plate. So there is no way how we can change this situation. The only way we can do is if we can cool in between each layer. So the system then will look like this. We have a processor. We have the through-silicon via. We have the next processor. And in between, we have fluid. This is also very much similar to how our brain runs. We have electrical signals, the nerves, and we have vessels, all intermingled on a very high density. So again, we can use the example of biology. The highest performance you get when you have the cooling and the signal transmission intermixed on a micron scale. And here you have a chip, you have the through silicon via. The thickness is then of the order of 100 to 200 microns. The pitch is very high, so you can have 1,000 times more lines between the layers, active layers. And of course, the important thing is, on what level do you communicate? Electrically, you would want to communicate with a pitch of about 5 to 10 microns. If you want to have a functioning liquid cooling system, we are restricted by the diameter of this capillary, which cannot be much lower than 25 micron. Currently, 100 micron is already a challenge. So that will be the kind of development direction we are going to walk along. So starting with 100 micron pitch, going then down to a smaller pitch, allowing more electrical connections, and still being able to transport enough heat away. We have to optimize how the through silicon vias are placed. So we want to place them so that we have kind of preferential channels, that the fluid flow is not obstructed too much. If you're building such a system, you have done so, test systems, 1 and 2 square centimeter test chips, we can show that we can remove 180 watts per square centimeter, which is almost as much as if we have a full thickness heatsink, about half of this. And now imagine you have 180 watts per square centimeter per layer, and you stack 10 layers. This 10-layer system fits in 1 cubic centimeter and consumes or can dissipate 7.2 kilowatts. That's as much as you dissipate in a rack. Due to the much smaller length of the wires, the efficiency or performance of such a cubic centimeter of processor will be 2 orders higher than the current efficiency of distributed electronics. So you will have, out of 1 cubic centimeter, the performance out of 100 racks. All becoming possible through the short distance how the transistors are placed. So the heat flux is huge, but if we tackle the heat flux, we can increase the efficiency and allow Moore's law to continue over a bit more than a decade on the same trend. So you all have seen that there is now the first petaflop system available. We are now, the race is open for the exaflop system. There is usually 11 years between between each factor 1,000. So we have 11 years to build such a system. And with such an interlayer cooled chip stack, an exaflop system will be possible. There is a lot more to it than just building fluids. We need to do an electrothermal co-design, so we need to really understand the interaction between the liquid-cooled system and the electrical design, how we can place the hotspots, how we can place the interconnects, where the fluid is flowing through, through silicon via architecture we select, and everything has to be optimized in several iterations. And we are building currently chip stacks like this. So now, this capability, being able to remove heat very efficiently, we can use not to make the chip more powerful in terms of megaflops per watt, but to make it more efficient. Now, I have to explain what we're doing. So we have developed these excellent heat removal devices. They have a very low internal thermal resistance. I compare this to the way how we are running a data center now. Transistor is 85 degrees. We are having a lot of thermal resistances for the heat flux. It flows through the chip, through the thermal interface material, I explained that before, through the chip cap, into the air cooler, eventually into the computer room air conditioner and the heat sink, the heat pump, the chiller. And we are ending at the temperature of 10 degrees Celsius. So from 85 to 10 makes 75 degrees. Gradient is needed to passively move the heat out of the chip. And then we are paying with a lot of energy to pump it out, pump it up, so that we can throw it away. Because we only can throw away energy above the ambient temperature. This is a silly way to drive it. In view that we have the technology available to capture the heat at 60 degrees C or 170 degrees Fahrenheit. The transistor is at the same temperature. There is no change for the transistor. We just changed the thermal resistance of our equipment, and we have it. We have microtechnology available now. We just need to bring the two systems together. If we do so, we can collect the heat from each chip and eventually collect it in a data center and make it available for space heating. And space heating in a northern country like Central Europe, where I'm coming from, we're using about 30% of our carbon footprint to do space heating. And space heating is done using fluid. The fluid temperature in most of our newer systems is 60 degrees C. So we can one-to-one provide the energy from a data center to do this space heating. And our market is actually quite large. It's 30% of the footprint. Data centers consume 2%, so our market is 15 times larger. We can sell into that. And the other good thing is, a kilowatt hour of heat in a district heating system, in an existing one that we don't need to build ourselves, is worth about half as much as a kilowatt hour of electricity. So what does that mean? If we're building such a system, we can reduce our energy consumption by 40% by eliminating the heat pump, and we can sell the 60% into a district heating system, getting back 30% of our money, which means the overall energy cost to run the data center is 3 times lower. By investing a little bit into the thermal management. It works not only in a cold climate, it's most efficient in a cold climate because you can sell the heat that effectively reduces your carbon footprint. This is a so-called physical offset. And we're saving only a little energy. That's a cold climate, Montreal Anchorage. Moderate climate, we are saving the roughly 40% of energy and reducing the carbon footprint more because we sell in winter, not the entire year. In a hot climate like Las Vegas, we save a lot of energy because the chiller needs a lot of energy there. And with a 60 degree C hot water cooled system, we can throw out the chillers. We do not need a chiller, not even in the hottest climate. So there is no climate on the globe that has more than 60 degrees C or 170 degrees Fahrenheit daytime temperature. So that means we can build a system worldwide. And in Europe, there is a lot of heat distribution systems available. They are transporting roughly 6% of total thermal demand, 5,000 district heating systems. And district heating is much more widespread still than wind and solar as an alternative energy. There is a lot of waste incineration that is used to drive this in Europe. Germany, Switzerland are on a 6% average. For example, Denmark transports 50% of the ore. So the northern country, they sometimes have very large fractions. Now, what are the energy fluxes in a conventional data center? I've said that several times. Same amount of energy that goes into the data center or into the box goes into the chiller. Everything is thrown out. That gives us a large carbon dioxide footprint. Now, we can do something that we are doing in the Zurich Research Lab. We can invest a little bit more of electricity into the chiller, pump up the heat from the air-cooled data center. This will reduce the carbon footprint slightly because we have a physical offset. We can reduce our expense for heating. But it's not the real solution. The real solution is if we can directly provide the heat, the medium-grade heat, from the data center. Then we can massively reduce our carbon footprint. The vision is in 5 years we have a zero-emission data center, so all heat is captured and transferred. At the moment, we can get about 85% captured at the required temperature level, 60 degrees C or 170 degrees Fahrenheit. This only works if the power station is also combined heat and power station. Then we have the possibility to reach a zero emission. Or, by the way, if you're driving the data center from a hydropower station, we have negative emission because we're using the heat, the energy twice. So what systems are currently being built? So we have the rear door heat exchanger that can slightly reduce the energy consumption since it captures the temperature at a slightly higher level on this graph that I showed before. Another system that is being built is a processor-cooled system, P575, and that runs with cold water cooling. So the performance of the heat sinks is not to the technical capability of microtechnology. It's a standard heat exchanger that allows cold water cooling, eliminates the need for a chiller, but doesn't provide reusable heat. The next system is a system called Q-Pace. That's a collaboration done in Germany by IBM Böblingen. And they are building a warm water cooled system. It's a rack with small blades or cards that each have a common heatsink that can capture the heat at a medium level, doesn't need any more air cooling. It's being combined onto a common cold plate here and allows about 100 Fahrenheit, 35 degrees cooling temperature, liquid cooling. That allows to, in the climate, local climate there in Germany, to cool without chiller, free cooling during the entire year, but not reuse, or reuse only in selected cases. For example, swimming pools or so, that's enough. So the demand, the market to sell into is then very small, but already possible. And this is the hot water cooled system that we've built at IBM Zurich or Rishlikon. So we compared three different systems. The standard air cooled system with a cold water cooled system and a hot water cooled system. And you see, by cold water cooling and investment into a high performance liquid cooler, you can save a little bit of energy. So your short circuit currents in a chip go down, you save about 8%. If you're now doing hot water cooling, our design point was we consume exactly the same amount as the air cooled system, but we sell the heat. So we have 75% here in our system of the heat sold. And that, with a value of heat being half the value of electricity, gives us a 37.5%, which we compare against the 8%. So we are definitely win. So the hot water cooled system is a better system than a cold water cooled system. That was the important demonstration we wanted to make. And now we are building a larger system for the Technical University in Switzerland, ETH. It's a mix, a hybrid system of QS cell chips and HS. So it's this Roadrunner that I showed before, a mini Roadrunner, but hot water cooled. So the Roadrunner is currently leading the efficiency list, the Green 500 list. And our goal is to have a world record in efficiency, a much lower energy consumption, and of course showing the feasibility of the concept and being able to accelerate commercialization. So if there is enough interest, it's possible to build a commercial system out of that. Again here, so we are currently building the system. We plan to finish it in April and connect it to the district heating system run by the ETH. So they have 60 buildings, they're all connected thermally, and we can supply into that network. And that allows us to do this physical offset. We are starting with a very efficient machine, the Roadrunner type machine. So we are tuned that slightly to get a world record in electrical performance, as well as best megaflops per gram CO2 emitted. I mean, it will become almost infinite if it's a zero emission system. And of course, having a PUE of less than one, because again, we are selling heat, and that allows us to reduce the effective energy or carbon footprint of the system. For those who are interested to change their data center, we have a tool that's called Going Green Impact Tool. Of course, you need to invest in order to get a hot water cooled system. If you're doing it on a prototype level, the added cost will be of the order of 30% on a prototype level. If it's on a larger volume level, the added hardware cost will be of the order of 10%. But the potential is very large. Total cost of ownership can be reduced by almost a factor of two or three. And that can be calculated here with this tool. So yeah, that brings me to the summary. So we are currently facing a paradigm change of how data centers are run. In the past, air-cooled was perfect. All engineers that built data centers learned that in that time. Now, as energy cost exceeds hardware cost, we have a paradigm change. And the way how we run data centers is wrong. We need to change it. And hot liquid cooling is a solution, how to run data centers in the future. And that will have a big effect on the energy, 40%, and an even bigger effect on the emission. Yeah, that's really key for future data centers. It will be a long roadmap, because we can, the closer we go to the chip, the more efficient we can capture the heat. We can capture it even more efficient from a 3D stack. So that will be an even better zero emission data center. And we are now ready to build systems in larger volume. So if you're ready, we're ready as well. And the same technology we are also using to improve the efficiency of a solar concentrator. It's the chip. Heat flux is 100 watts or 200 watts per square centimeter. We have a very efficient heat transfer from the photovoltaic chip into the fluid. The other aspect we want to explore with that is we have found consumers of heat in winter in a cold climate. Is there consumers of heat in a cold climate? Yes, there is. Desalination. Desalination is the main energy consumer in hot climates, and that can be supplied by a concentrated photovoltaic system. We are having an output heat of 90 degrees C. But it also can be supplied from a data center. You can run a multi-effect boiling plant with a data center. So we also have consumers for hot climate. That's the next step. Next but one step is if you have a high grade or a higher grade heat, you can also cool with the heat. And the tool that does that is an absorption chiller. So we're going to integrate absorption chillers so that we have consumers even in hot climates. That means we can sell the heat whether it's cold or hot, and reduce the carbon footprint of the data center to zero in all climates, in all years, and increase the electrical efficiency of the data center. Okay, yeah, so that brings me to the end. I'd like to thank for your attention. And of course, this has been achieved only with the contribution of a lot of people. So you see the long list here. Different locations, the group in Zurich, microfabrication was important, Böblingen Development, Yorktown, Poughkeepsie's Fishkill, Austin, and even more.
Pragmatically, what does this mean for people servicing the equipment? I mean, are we going to need plumber's putty or something like this? I mean, you know, pragmatically, what is it going to affect pulling boards?
Yes. So what we are doing is we are trying to minimize the change how you experience when you run a system. So I can show you one example. We're having a liquid cool plate center. So you still plug the blade, it's a liquid cool plate, and you can run the system the same. So you don't notice a big difference. Well, of course, your facility will have a coolant distribution unit in addition, and it needs to have another circuit for heat transport. So it needs not only the cold water transport in the data center, but it needs a second set of a pair of tubes that transports then the 60 to 65 degree C temperature.
And what about the choice of water? I mean it's sort of cheap and all, but when you tend to have warm water running around for long periods of time, you get microbial growth and things like that. Had you considered other fluids?
Yes, of course. Chemical corrosion in water systems is a problem, and that needs to be explored over long term. So we're using the experience that has been gathered in the first round when liquid cooling was already running, and these systems ran for 10 years before they were dismantled, and it's possible to keep a liquid cooled system stable for 5 to 10 years.
Hi.
Hello.
Mary Beth Griffin, Carnegie Mellon. I had a question about one of the particular chipsets you're talking about. You said the radially oscillating flow chip, way back. You mentioned it was completely sealed, so it could be used for, say, a mobile device. Is it actually in use yet in laptops, or is it just something it's planned to be, or, you know, when we get to that point?
Yes. We developed this radially oscillating liquid cooling technology. The benefit is roughly a factor of 2 in terms of thermal performance of this system, but the complexity of this system is quite high. So we are not sure whether this will be the technology coming up in notebooks in next time. It's one tool that we have in our toolbox that could be helpful in some points, but we don't predict that it will be the key technology.
Okay, because it occurred to me that a lot of people I know use laptops at not flat angles, and that would probably do something very weird to this sort of system, and that would have to be taken into account if it was built in. But aside from that, I'd like to not have my lap burn in one spot. Let's balance the heat out. Thank you for the talk. It was wonderful.
The talk was amazing. Thank you. Pamela Howell, Esoteric Resources. I have two questions, if I might. The first one is, do you know why it's called C4 technology? No, it's driving me nuts.
C4?
Yeah.
Sorry, that was a technical term. So we are fabricating the electronic circuits, the chips, on a wafer. So it's this large dish that you see in some pictures. And then the chips, our transistors are fabricated, all the wiring levels are added. Then the wafers are cut into the little pieces, the 2x2 centimeter chips. Okay. And then we are adding solder balls, little balls, by machine. All the interconnects are being added. And then the whole thing is flipped. And then it's being put onto matching contacts on a carrier, on a PCB board or on a ceramic carrier, and then it's being heated to about 280 degrees, and then it's called, as I don't know, it's four C's.
Okay.
It's controlled collapse of, I don't know these other two words. So that means all solder balls are then melted at the same time and form all the connections. And these are usually 4,000 connections which are formed at the same time without any short circuits and so on. It was really an important technology to allow an efficient interconnect between the chips and the substrate. The alternative that was used about 10 years ago or in the past was wire bonding. So there the chip was run upside, not flipped, and there were wires being, so you melted them locally to a surface and then pulled the wire and melted to the chip. That's an instrument that goes very fast. But the problem is that the wire is floppy and the resistance and capacitance of this wire is very bad. So wire bonding is definitely not the technology of choice. C4 technology, is it?
And it has nothing to do with anything plastic.
Yes. Okay.
Or blowing
great.
Things up.
Controlled collapse chip connect.
Thank you. My follow-on question is a little bit bigger than that. It sounds to me like you've almost solved global warming, photovoltaic, and desalination. How do you feel?
Again, how we do...
I'm sorry?
How we do all of them?
How do you feel about it?
How we feel?
You, personally.
Yeah, great.
I have to say me too. Thank you for a great talk.
Doug Hughes from DE Shaw Research. I know it's not directly related to the thesis of your talk, but I'm wondering if you have any experiences with using just basically outside air for cooling a data center, just sort of pumping it in and then sending outside. And there's problems with humidification and dust and everything, but how do you feel about like the overall efficiency of that sort of solution?
Yeah, so I'm not an expert in operation of air-cooled data centers, so our expertise is clearly the liquid-cooled. I know a little bit from my colleagues how that works. So it's very bad to pump out the heat of a data center with a chiller. So it's much better to try to build a data center that the thermal resistances are slightly reduced. And so that you're above the level of the ambient temperature. It works especially well in a colder climate where your ambient temperature is of the order of 20 degrees C or even lower. And then you can disable the heat pump and use outside air. So using outside air eliminates one of these thermal resistances and of course saves the energy of the chiller. But the problem you have is that with outside air, you also get outside pollutants into the data center. So you get dust into the data center. If you don't want that, you need filters. The smaller pores the filter have, the more electrical energy you need to suck the air to the filter. So you need a lot of pumping power still for the ventilators. And the corrosion is a problem. The corrosion is a problem. Not only for the outside air-cooled data centers, even for data centers that have a small fraction of exchange air. So we, for example, in China, we have data centers that keep failing all the time because of pollutants. So pollutants will be an important problem for for free cooled data centers.
Thank you.
But again, the cooling is for free, but the heat is wasted still. So we want the heat to become useful. And then you need to push the temperature a lot more. And as soon as you have air cooling, air as a transport medium in this chain, it will not allow you to get high enough temperatures.
Steven Spackman, I spent most of my life living in the province of Quebec. This idea that you burn things in order to get power is a little weird to me. I grew up in a town with its own hydro dam, which we use the national grid if that failed for some obscure reason. So obviously the packaging density arguments remain compelling, even if you're getting your power from hydroelectric. But what happens to the rest of the argument? We are used to heating our houses directly from electricity, no fluids involved, using energy that would have been converted to heat by the waterfall anyway. In some places, electricity is still cheap. It doesn't involve carbon emissions. How does the argument change in that situation?
Yeah, okay, so I agree. If you're having hydroelectricity, then you don't have a carbon dioxide emission being associated with that. But still, electrical energy has a very high value. So it's electrical energy is more valuable than thermal energy. Since you can run a data center and still heat your house, or you can have a combined heat and power station being driven and creating the electricity and still have the heat. So the concept that you need to understand is the concept of exergy. So that's the scientific base. So electrical energy has a content of 100% exergy. If you use electrical energy to heat your home, which is body temperature, that's what you would want, or 20 degrees C, then you only use about 10% of the exergy content of your electricity. And that's in principle a waste. You said most houses are heated electrically, but even if you're using a combustion process, like burning oil to heat your home, oil has a 100% exergy content. For heating a home, you only use 10%, so it's a waste of exergy. So there is much better ways how you could use this electrical energy than to do the heating, the resistive heating. So I guess I can recommend a good talk that explains some of these aspects. It's by Saul Griffiths, and he calls it a game plan. And what he tells, we are all energy illiterate. We have to understand energy better in the future. And please look at this talk. That's very interesting. Also myself, I had to learn a lot in terms of understanding these different aspects of energy, the energy aspect and the exergy aspect. And it's not simple to explain, but it is important that all of us try to learn these concepts and understand the use of energy better.
So for those of us who do live in hydroelectric areas, is it environmentally responsible to heat our homes by contributing to global computation projects?
No, I would still run a data center off of the electricity and heat the home afterwards.
Thank you.